I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The best things happen after dark. Nightclubs are the ultimate spaces for self-expression, escape, music, socializing, and forgetting for a moment the outside world. Going out is a way to discover ourselves, who we really are, what we really like. We find new friends and fall in love on the dance floor. As humans, we like to move to a beat, and there's nothing like a good night out. I'm Jody Harsh. I'm a DJ and producer, and I've spent most of my life going out. I know how to tear up a dance floor, and in this podcast, I chat with my guests about how club culture and going out has helped shape their identities and inform their work. In season one, we were locked down, unable to partake in nocturnal activities, so we could only talk about our memories of nightlife. Now we're back out there, and I've got a truly amazing guest list for season two. So let's dive into those hazy memory banks and hit the floor. This is Life of the Party. Today's guest is the big-mouthed, meme-posting DJ extraordinaire, who also happens to be one of my best friends. He's lived 10 lives, much of which is written about in his brand new book, and his DJ career is flying more than ever. If there's a club, he's played it, a party, he's been to it, a line, he snorted it. He is, of course, the man, the myth, the legend, DJ Fat Tony. So let's begin right back at the start. You're from London. Was it a lively atmosphere in your house when you were growing up?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, I grew up on a council estate in Battersea, and it was a very lively council estate. You know, it was a new building, so everyone who moved there, it relatively got on with each other because they all put in there at the same time. So it wasn't somewhere that you come into, people have been living there for 20 years, so it was their territory. So everyone kind of owned their own part of that estate. And right. So growing up in that environment was very lively. I mean, you know, we had a brick wall that we all used to sit on called the wall.
That's original.
I know, right? But everyone used to go there and hang out on this wall.
Yeah.
And that's where trouble would always be caused, you know. It's like, you go, oh, let's go and rob that shop window, or let's go and smash that door in, or, you know, and that's how it was.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. And you stress up from an early age as well. Have you always been a showman?
Well, I always have, you know. Yeah. I talk about it in the book, you know, growing up, like, literally, I remember we had, on our estate, we had, like, a tenants association, and we all went to Margate, and I must have been about 6 or 7, and I bought some plastic tits from a joke shop, and I was obsessed with these plastic tits, and I wore them everywhere. So, you know, growing up on that council estate where everyone was skinheads and I was running around in plastic tits, I was always the showman.
Did you get any shit for it?
Yeah, of course, but you know what? My brother always looked after me.
Yeah.
And, my dad was 6'4" with fingers like bananas. No one really messed with us.
Right.
I mean, I could look after myself. I always did look after myself.
Yeah.
You know, if someone gave me shit, I gave it back.
With your mouth?
Yeah, always.
Yeah.
And I kind of just think, you know, and then it kind of progressed from the growing up bit, was kind of like from the age of 13, really. I started doing drag and going out the house. I discovered nightclubs.
Yeah.
Which we're here to talk about, right?
Yeah. And was music part of your family as well?
Oh, music was a major part of our family. My grandmother was a classical pianist and taught piano.
Wow.
I was shit at it, so right. She never really taught. She taught, gave me 2 lessons and that was it.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? She was like, no.
You couldn't concentrate.
The ADHD taking it.
Already kicked in.
Yeah, really big time by then. But So music was a really big part of our family. So my dad was music obsessed. My mum come from she grew up in the swinging 60s, so she loved music. So in our house at weekends, like Saturday and Sunday, all that you woke up to, music. Yeah. Music was being blared out in our house all the time. And then my older brother was into, like, lovers rock and soul music. So he was obsessed by playing it as well.
Yeah.
And, like, we'd have the speakers out of our windows. So my brother would have speakers out of his bedroom window at the front, and I'd have speakers out of the bedroom window on the back.
It's two parties.
Yeah,
simultaneously.
Two parties. Literally. Troublemaking. Just trying to outdo each other. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then my dad would have his music on downstairs. I mean, you know, it was a very musical household.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So when you first started actually hitting nightclubs, where were you going? Like, what was the first club?
First
you ever
club I went to was the Embassy.
Oh, right.
Yeah, it was the Embassy, the first club.
Covent Garden?
It was in Mayfair.
Oh, Mayfair, of course. Bond Street.
Bond Street, yeah. On the right hand side. So, so I was shagging this Leather Queen called Roy. And he was the manager there.
Right.
And he took me there. He was like, oh, yeah, come one night. So I went and met him from work, and I remember going there. I remember exactly what I was wearing as well. I was wearing, like, a electric blue Puma jumper. I can remember it to this day. I had a V-neck. It's really bizarre that I still remember. And I went there and was sitting there, and I was just blown away by it.
Yeah.
And then from
there... Do you
remember
the feeling when you first walked
in? I'd arrived.
Yeah.
I walked in and I just thought, this is going to be my life from now on.
Yeah,
I love it. It was just like, you know... Because at that point in time, I was already had a job on the King's Road. Mm. So I kind of was always surrounded by people from that world anyway.
Yeah. How old were you when you first went to a club?
13.
13, right? Yeah, really young. Yeah,
14.
Yeah.
And I started from there. Then it was Cha-Cha's, which was Behind Heaven, which was a Tuesday night, which Scarlett, who was very big on the scene back then, like look-wise, you know, it's just after, on the tail end of New Romanticism, I can't even say it because... I hated it that much, but you know, there was on the tail end of that, and so Tuesday nights was Cha-Cha's, and I used to go there, and I used to go and drag,
right?
Because that way I could get in without anyone knowing my age,
without anyone IDing you,
totally,
yeah, totally.
You know, it was the fact that I always lied about my age to everyone,
right?
Oh, right, though, until I was 50. When I just got to 50, I thought, fuck it, I'm gonna own it.
You did a 50th birthday,
yeah, you know what I mean? And I just, you know, it's the first time I actually stopped lying, because I always told when I was older, and then when I got to 27, I always it started to get younger.
Right.
Do you know, it was very bizarre.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, even though I probably, at the height of my addiction, I probably looked 110, I'd still say to people,
21,
like, do you know what I mean? Like, literally. But, like, I always lied. So I always told men I was 18. I always told people I was 16, 17. Yeah. I was 13, I was 14.
Yeah. What did you hate about the New Romantic era?
That I wasn't a part of it.
Right.
Literally.
Yeah.
That was it. I hated the fact that I was too young for it.
Right.
I was too young for punk. I was too young for that. You know, when punk was out in 1977, you know, all the kids on the estate, like, that had been into skinheads and suddenly turned into punks and suddenly, you know, and then some of them went off to be like, got into like the whole New Romantic thing. But it was really, punk was a really big thing on my estate. I was too young for that.
Right. Yeah. And then you were hanging out with George as well in clubs and stuff.
I met him in the King's Road, actually. Because King's Road, I talk about this a lot. King's Road was our social media.
Yeah.
It was a place that everybody went on a Saturday to be seen. You would walk up and down King's Road. To be discovered, you would walk up and down King's Road.
Literally, like, for music and stuff
like that. Everything.
Yeah.
It was literally everyone. So, designer-wise, on a Saturday afternoon, you would see Jean-Paul Gaultier there. You would see Riff at Osborne. Everyone would hang out in the King's Road because that's where the looks were. That's where people went. John Galliano, John Flett, everyone hung out in King's Road.
Westwood Shop was there?
Yeah, World's End was down the end. You had Robot Creepers, which was a shoe shop on the corner which sold creepers and stuff like that. That was a really classical shop. You had Johnson's, which was at the end, Johnson's was like a rocker's shop, but they did like gold fringe jackets. I mean, amazing stuff, La Rocker.
Yeah.
You had so many different shops. And then I worked in this place called the Great Gear Market, which where Rusty Egan had his first record shop.
Right.
In there called The Cage.
Yeah.
And then there was like Axiom, you had Melissa Kaplan, you had all the New Romantic designers working in there.
Yeah.
And you had the little leather shop in the corner that sold like poppers and leather. And,
right, for everyone to wear in Els Court.
Els Court was the gay mecca of the world as such.
And I guess Soho wasn't.
Soho wasn't. No. Soho at that point in time was still just sex shops and peep shows.
Right, right.
And it was very straight orientated.
Yeah.
You had no gay scene in Soho whatsoever, apart from the odd gay cinema that showed gay films,
right,
which had back rooms for sex.
Right, right.
That was the level of gay Soho.
Right.
It wasn't until much later that the Swiss Hotel turned into Compton's.
Ah.
So that was the first point of call for gays in Soho. Ah. That, and you had the Bear Pub up there, but that really, the Golden Lion, which is on opposite 16th Street, you know that well.
Yeah.
Opposite there.
That's the STD clinic. Yeah,
the Golden Lion, which was a rent boy pub, and then you had the Dilly, Piccadilly, which were both rent boy areas. The rest of it was just all strip clubs and and sex shops.
So it was all over in Earl's Court.
Yeah, Earl's Court. You had Copacabana, you had the Colon, which was the Leather Bar. You had Brompton's.
Yeah. Yeah.
You had all of these amazing, amazing venues, all in one little area.
And would they be sort of, were they like pubs basically, weren't
they? They were pubs, and there was the Copa's was a club.
Right, so they'd have little nights and stuff.
Yeah, they had like, you know, I saw Diana Dawes there actually.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, about 3 weeks before she died.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. So, you know, that it was it had its own scene. And, of course, what happened was AIDS came along and annihilated Earl's Court.
Yeah.
Everything shut down. People stopped going there because they fear of being attacked.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't just AIDS that wiped it out. It was the fear of AIDS that wiped out that scene.
Right, right.
People were just so scared of being around gay people.
Because
they thought they were going to catch it.
They weren't sure how it was transmitted.
No, totally. Yeah. And, you know, and the media really played a big part in that. Do you know what I mean? With falling gravestones. And you know, anytime there was any discussion of it, it was a gay disease.
Totally.
So Earl's Court was wiped out. And that, like, completely, it was like a tsunami had completely cleared out that area.
There's a much fabled story about Freddie Mercury giving you your first ever line of cocaine.
Yeah.
You opened the book with it, actually.
Yeah.
Can we hear the story and put it to bed?
Well, you know what? The reason it becomes a big, because I did that documentary with Mix Megan.
Yeah.
And in it, I just said, you know, Freddie had given me my first line of coke. And it was only a part of a sentence, a conversation. It wasn't me being like, this is the headline.
Right, right.
It's like the other one is like, I spent over £1 million on cocaine.
Yeah, that was my next question.
But do you get what I mean? Yet. They were all there because they were all a part of that conversation.
Yeah, yeah,
And that it's true. And, you know, Freddie actually, that night with them, I didn't know who Freddie Mercury was.
Right.
I didn't give a flying fuck about Queen.
Right.
I was in Soft Cell.
Right.
And Mark Almond and all those queens.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Queen was a different generation.
Right.
Queen was what my mum and dad played.
Was that 10 years before, right?
Yeah, my mum and dad played Queen on a Sunday morning. Do you get what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, I'd met him at Heaven on a Saturday night, the first time I ever went to Men Only on Heaven on Saturday night.
Is that what the night was called?
Well, it was only Men Only.
It was just Men Only, yeah.
Yeah. And you couldn't, no women were ever allowed in.
Yeah.
And that's when I first met that lot, and then went back to their house, and there was like 8 people.
Right.
So it wasn't just Freddie that gave me the line of coke.
Okay. Is that story about Freddie Mercury and Princess Diana to
Vauxhall Tavern.
RVT? Is that true?
That is true, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Diana in the Vauxhall Tavern.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, exactly right.
You then started hitting New York. I think you went on your 18th birthday.
Yeah, I flew to New York on... I badgered George, as in Boy George, into buying me a flight for on Concorde.
What was Concorde like?
Oh, Concorde was amazing.
Was it?
Yeah.
Concorde, it was like two seats next to George. It wasn't spacious,
was
it?
Two seats. It was so small inside. Grey leather.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you got to New York.
Was in New York for a while. And then by that point, when I was 18, I was doing a night called Café de Paris in London on a Wednesday night, which was the place to, I mean, it was.
Yeah.
Everything
recently
that we had
closed.
There. Yeah, but on a Wednesday back then, it was the hardest place to get into. It was the only place anyone ever wanted to go in London.
What was that night called?
Wednesday night at Café de Paris.
I love that name.
Well, no, it was like Nick Knight, a guy called Nick Fry ran it, and Albert from the Batty Clan in Paris.
Okay.
He would fly over on a Wednesday, and they had this guy called Jack on the door from Paris as well. And Albert would play all like swing and salsa, and like La Vie en Rose was one of these big ones. And then I would come on and start playing early house and disco
Amazing.
And stuff. And
what sort of year was this?
So Delight had just come out, It Out.
So like very early 90s.
Yeah,
like
very, 90 very early.
Or something, I would say. Yeah.
I was 18.
Right.
So then, of course, when I was going over to do New York, and I was hanging, you know, George lived on Columbus in 88, and I was like, I decided I was moving to New York at that point.
Yeah.
Only went for a week and then suddenly was like there.
Yeah.
And then I would come back and forth. And of course, you know, London, everyone in New York wanted to be in London.
Yeah.
And everyone in London really wanted to be in New York.
Yeah, I feel like it's still the same now,
you know,
isn't it?
Yeah. And you know, but New York back then in that time was just incredible because it was pre-Giuliani. It was pre the big clear out.
Yeah.
You know, you still had the hookers in the meatpacking district.
Yeah.
You still had the bathhouses just.
Yeah.
You still had that freedom of like, wow, this is what the village people were all about.
Totally.
Do you get what I'm saying to you?
Yeah.
You
know, and you've still got like Warhol still alive.
Oh,
at this
of course.
Point,
you know? I mean, I'd see Andy like most nights.
Really?
Yeah, literally.
Oh, so
he was the most annoying cunt in Under the Sun.
Polaroid Why was he annoying?
He was just always there. I've got two, no, like literally like creeping after George. But I had like, I got two Polaroids that he did.
Yeah.
Of me. One with me was Sade. And one with me with George.
And he was just annoying, that's so funny.
Well, he was, you know, he was just, hey. Yeah. I just found him really creepy.
And Haring as well, you're knocking about.
Yeah,
Keith Haring.
No, I loved Keith. Keith was everything that we loved. No, we loved.
Totally.
When you meet him, you know, it was like you'd be talking and be like, oh, who's that black guy over there?
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
he loved
Latinos and he loved black boys.
Okay.
But, you know, he was just, everything about Keith was just, he had freedom and he had fun. He knew how to have fun. And he was just, he was a real laugh.
Yeah. One club I really wish I went to, which I know you did, in New York, Area.
Area was incredible.
Oh, my God. Tell us about Area.
So not enough people talk about Area, and that's a shame about Area because
it's got a bit overshadowed by Studio 54.
Yeah, it did, because it was, you know, it came after.
Yeah.
So Area was this, like, you went in through the doors of Area and each month they would have a different theme.
Yeah.
You know, like you go to shitty clubs here and they have like a bit of polystyrene.
Yeah,
from the
inflatable.
And you know,
yeah.
Like, oh yeah, it's this part theme.
It's beach this week.
Yeah, and they'd put a bit of sawdust on the floor and the beach ball.
Yeah.
With Area, like, they ripped out the whole place.
Yeah.
So one time they had trailer trash and they built caravan parks inside. They had a garage in the middle of the club with petrol pumps. But not like props. I mean, seriously built.
Yeah.
But when you walked in, you walked down these long corridors which had shop windows all the way down. And in each window, they had a different theme. So once we went and they had Alice in Wonderland and they had a guy dressed as sitting on a mushroom as a caterpillar smoking a shisha.
Yeah.
But it was just so brilliantly done.
And the artists used to like take over rooms and stuff,
everyone,
right?
Yeah. I mean, it was, you know, It was insane. It was absolutely insane. You just literally believed in it. And I remember they had the best one. The best thing they ever had was La Area Discoteca, and you went in, and outside they had one of these pull down blinds, you know, like shop blinds. But it went around there with in red plastic, and it had La Area Discoteca, and they had like broken lights outside, and they made it look like it was like an old rundown disco.
Amazing.
Honestly, when you went in, they had a disco dance floor, they had the VIP room, because they never had a VIP room at the Area.
Right.
But for La Discoteca, they had a VIP room.
Amazing.
And everyone wanted to be in the VIP room.
Amazing. Of course.
Because it worked.
Yeah.
You know, it was just such, the amount, I just think, who's paying for it?
Yeah, and it was Steve. Was it Steve Rebell?
It was Steve again.
Yeah, it was Steve.
And what's his name?
From he owns all the hotels now.
Schrager. Ian Schrager.
Yeah,
it was a Schrager club, and you know, it was so brilliantly done.
Yeah,
but also there was, you know, there was Danceteria, which was Brill's.
Yeah,
Diane Brill and Rudolph.
Right.
Theirs, and that was incredible.
Danceteria is where Madonna shot Get Into the Groove.
That's right.
Yeah,
she did. Danceteria was amazing. Because you had the lift and you went up and it was just amazing.
Was it upstairs?
Yeah, you went. There was like different floors to it. It was so genius.
Yeah.
All those clubs were back then, you know, and Save the Robots, which was down on the Alphabets. It was on Avenue A. And you'd go down there and which World was down there as well. But, you know, you'd go to Avenue A and people were like, you're going to Avenue A at 3 a.m.
Oh, it was so dodgy.
Dodgy ain't the word.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, it was, but you just didn't think about it because we discovered ecstasy.
Yeah.
We discovered MDMA.
Yeah.
Which was your next question.
Which is my next question. Literally, you're like preempting every single question. So we get back to London.
Yeah.
And ecstasy has taken her. Ecstasy's basically...
You know, it
was a game changer, wasn't it?
It was a major game changer.
Yeah.
You know, for us, it was, you know, we'd be at Palladium in New York and we'd be buying, like... Little grand bottles of it, in little brown bottles with
like
brown
cap.
Yes.
Oh, right.
And you'd do five dots. We'd do dices. We'd do five dots on here and we'd like that.
Oh.
Yeah, very graphic.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I have a relapse now. Yeah. And literally, you know, you wouldn't be happy until you got shutter eye. And really clean MDMA used to, you'd take it and before you know it, your eyes would be like, shh.
Oh, like vibrate it.
Like shuttering. Like your vision would be like, and you'd be like, yeah, yeah.
Because you're like rushing.
Yeah, rushing. Yeah. And that was just like really clean MDMA. And then you'd be gouging and you'd want to chuck up and you'd chuck up in the corner and you'd be fine.
Right.
And that was MDMA.
Who hasn't thrown up
and
on
that whole
pill
feeling.
As well,
but you know, but then when it came to London, we had that for a couple of months, for about 3 or 4 months, that feeling. And then suddenly when everyone started to make it in London, it started to get really dirty and it started to become, you know, but for a good 6 to 8 months, it changed the whole of London.
Yeah. And is that when the rave scene?
Yeah.
And that's when you were on motorways?
Up and down the motorways, you know, it was in fields, in, you know.
And you have to get phone numbers to call and
find
addresses. Yeah,
from phone boxes and stuff like that. I mean, obviously we didn't because we were working at them.
You were DJing the parties, yeah, of course.
Yeah, I mean, I DJed probably nearly, I mean, I we're doing a rave, a flyer book,
yeah,
a coffee table
amazing
book,
yeah,
of all the club flyers that I've on over the years.
Amazing.
And we're getting them in at the moment. And it's like, literally, I forgot how many fucking thousands of parties I did in that time.
So would you be literally like Saturday night up to...
four different places.
Staffordshire or something like...
Literally, yeah.
Field.
In air hangars and like old derelict building sites. But I'm doing... Tomorrow morning I'm filming in Battersea Power Station because I did a rave in Battersea Power Station.
When it was...
In 89.
Wow.
In 89. Like, did a rave in there. And we're talking about that tomorrow because they're reopening it and I'm doing this big part of their promotion because I'm a Battersea boy.
Wow, of course.
So...
Yeah.
Yeah, so, but yeah, rave culture, you know, we drove everywhere. And then it just got really, it got really criminalised really quickly and got really dark very quickly. People realised they could make money, like everything.
Yeah.
You know, whether it be crypto, absolute NFTs.
Yeah,
have you met anyone who does an NFT?
Yeah, right.
But like used car salesman. Do you know what I mean? You just look at them and you think, hang on a minute.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
That's not even real.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you know, you're not laundering, are you? But do you get what I mean? It's kind of everything that comes along always gets criminalized really quickly because it's not licensed.
But I guess this
anything
is
that's under the radar gets taken over.
I guess this is pre-festivals, though. I mean, obviously, Glastonbury's going on.
100%.
Festivals, I guess, are the new... Do raves still happen now?
Like they used to, all up the country.
Yeah.
Especially through lockdown.
Yeah.
They really made a big comeback really quickly.
A lot in the media.
And I mean,
I got
asked to do loads and I had to turn them down because, you know, I'm not in a position where I can't be saying, oh, we're fighting for freedom and then suddenly doing an illegal rave.
Totally.
At the same time. Although my heart would have been in that rave constantly,
totally,
as you know.
And I guess in COVID as well, you have to think...
Yeah, of course, there's other people involved.
Yeah,
it's
not
about me wanting to, you know... I was quite happy just doing it in my garden.
Yeah, which we're
going to
do. Which is my
next question.
As I want to run through a load of clubs that are synonymous with you and chat about like what they were like and like the scene that went along with each one. So, first of all, the WAG Club.
So the WAG was the centre of the universe.
Right.
It really was the centre of the
Soho.
Universe. It was in Wardour Street.
Yeah.
It was above a betting shop.
Right.
Opposite, right by the gates of Chinatown.
Right
opposite.
Yeah.
It's now a... O'Neill's pub.
I know exactly what you mean. Was that
windows.
The WAG? Oh yeah, I know.
There's two glass windows.
It's a little alleyway going down
just
the side.
The blue belt. It's just further up on the left there. And it basically the blind's still there. The sign was outside. So the blind would come down and cover up the betting office and you'd go up the stairs. And basically it was run by Chris Sullivan and Ollie O'Donnell. They basically used to do the Kit Kat and all of the New Romantic stuff. They took over Whiskey A Go-Go.
Right.
So it used to be Whiskey A Go-Go.
Right.
And then they turned it into... First of all, they turned it into... what was it called? I've forgotten the name of it. They took it over and they transformed it into this thing that just didn't work.
Yeah.
Le Rococo.
Okay.
It was called Rococo for about 2 weeks. And then they changed it to WAG. And WAG primarily, on a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, was a jazz club.
Right.
Friday nights, it was all about jazz. It was all about that scene, all about the, you know, Northern Soul. They catered for everyone. Then Saturdays was all about... soul music and stuff like that. So then what happened was I discovered I wanted to be a DJ.
Right.
Started doing the... I started off at the Lyceum. It's very small.
Right.
the actual Lyceum. The Lion theater. King.
Oh, yeah. Really?
Yeah, DJing
was
there. What,
was it just called the Lyceum?
No, it was called Playground on a Saturday night. It was Steve Strange, Rusty Egan and Kevin Millions, who went on to do Jungle and Heaven. They opened this Saturday night thing. And I, being me... went to them and said to Rusty, you don't want to open a Saturday night because I'm opening one.
Right, right.
And he was like, what? I said, yeah, I'm opening a night the same night. And he's like, well, don't do that. Why don't you come and work for us instead? I was like, I'll think about it. Yeah. I weren't opening nothing. I couldn't even open a fucking pint of milk.
I get a crisp.
Do you know what I mean? And he went, we'll give you a job on the door. And I was like, fine, okay.
Yeah.
So off I went. So each week I was inviting people and, of course, signing in the back room, hosting it. And every week I'd say, he's like, how was it? I was like, everyone's leaving. And he was like, why? I said, the music's so shit. Everyone's sagging the music up. And he'd be like, what? I was like, everyone.
Is this Rusty Egan?
Rusty DJ, so DJ and yeah. Ian Dewhurst.
Right, okay.
Now, Ian Dewhurst at that point was like the king of, like, he did all that, like DMX, all that stuff, all those like master mix, master cuts.
Yeah, yeah.
He was master cuts.
Right.
And he was like, I'd be like, I think he was rude to me once. I think that's what it was all about.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway,
like,
everyone said he's shit and they're all leaving. And Rusty said to me, well, if you think you can do better, why don't you do it? And I was like, all right, I will. And then the next week, I turned up with four records. Four records. Natalie Cole, Pink Cadillac.
Yeah.
ABC remix. I don't know which one it was.
By the Jacksons?
No. By the band ABC.
Oh, okay.
Lexicon of Love, those guys. Divine.
Amazing. Native Love.
Take It Like a Man.
Take It Like a Man. Amazing, yeah.
And then I can't think what the fourth one was. It was, Who's Zooming Who? Who's Zooming
Who?
Yeah. Aretha Franklin. Yeah. Took those. That was it. Played both B-sides and A-sides. And that was it. And then within 2 weeks...
That's a short set.
Babe, I could turn, like, I'm disco genius. I can turn 12 records into a 4-hour set. Within 2 weeks, we'd start Tuesday nights at the Wag. Me and a guy called Stephen Linnard, who was a fashion designer.
Okay.
And we'd total fashion victim at the Wag.
Yeah.
And that's where we first met Andy Warhol.
Right.
So we'd been doing it for 3 or 4 weeks, and Andy came to London and was at, and this guy, Billy Beyond came in, and they were like, we got Andy outside in the car. He wants to come in, and we were like, yeah, he's got to pay.
Yeah, you charge Andy Warhol. Yeah.
And then they were like, can he come in? I was like, yeah, he can come in. So that was so that's how it all kind of started stemming off.
Got it.
And then I got invited to go over to do Palladium.
That's how
the ball rolled on that one.
Got it.
But, you know, with the Wag, I'm a great cuckoo. I always start off with just doing one little thing, and then next minute I'm running the whole place.
Yeah.
And I basically just decided I wanted to do Saturday nights.
Yeah.
And started off DJing, and then within about a month it became Attitude at the Wag, and then it became Fatitude at the Wag.
Fatitude.
Then we did Fat at the Wag on Saturday nights, and it went for 9 years.
Wow. And so everyone's coming and hanging out. And
literally,
that's the spot.
Everyone. So, you know, in that DJ box, you know, Nana Cherry just did a film about it the other day, talking about how she met Cameron on Ecstasy in my DJ box.
Wow.
George Michael used to hang out in the DJ box. Everyone used to come and hang out on Saturday at the Wag. Mark Moore, I gave him his job there.
Yeah.
Tim from On the Bass, and all of those kids used to come, and that's kind of where they started their careers. You know, literally, yeah. It just spiraled out of control, and it was just such an amazing thing. And that's kind of where we discovered house music and just it just projected everything for me.
And then what about Limelight? Was that
so
around the
Limelight
same time?
Was another one of those you need me jobs.
Yeah.
So Peter Gation, who owned Limelight.
Oh, from Limelight New York.
Yeah, it's the same, you know, they came to London and they'd just got the old Welsh church at the end of Shaftesbury Avenue, which had been derelict for years.
Right.
And they were like, we're going to turn this into Limelight. And I was like, okay, right. And he was like, so, you know, we want you to come and work for us, do a night, DJ for us. And I was like, no, I don't DJ for no one. So you want me to come, you need to put me on a retainer and you need me to run it for you. I was, no one's going to come for you.
Yeah.
And they were like looking at me like as if who the fuck is this 18-year-old telling us that he can run us out of town?
His chancer.
Literally, yeah. I was a chancer.
Yeah.
And within a month, I'd been on a retainer. I was earning like $3,000 a week.
Wow, yeah.
Back then, I mean, that's fucking extortion. You know, no wonder I was an addict. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And I literally was doing the limelight, doing just there every night.
Wow. It
literally just, yeah.
And that's not, it's like some art centre now or something, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's
they're
like
turning it into a community art space, which is great.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's Limelight was Limelight.
Yeah.
Do you get what I mean? People don't talk about that as much as they should either. It was an incredible space.
How much has Soho changed?
Oh, the two comparisons, right, are like Dalston High Street and Westfield.
Yeah.
Now, that's what it's like. So it's gone from Dalston High Street to Westfield. That's how it's changed. That's how you just... And people go, yeah, it's gentrification and it's really good. Yes, it is really good, because if it stayed the same, it would be really fucking boring.
Yeah, and
it's like when people say, oh, I don't get it anymore, it's not the same. Thank fuck it's not the same.
Yeah.
God almighty, can you play? Imagine playing the same 12 records?
Yeah.
Well, you can.
Fuck off.
No, but you get what I mean? It's like literally, things have to change. They evolve, they grow big, they die, they move on.
Yeah, and areas move on. Yeah.
Yeah, they do. And, you know, it's sometimes I walk through Soho and I just think, it's soul-destroying, because I lived on that street. I lived on Old Common Street.
Yeah,
I lived on Old Common Street for 11 years.
Wow.
And I watched that place grow. I remember, you know, Compton's opening.
Yeah.
Then I moved in with my boyfriend that I met in Russell Square on Old Compton Street.
You live above Balance Cafe or something?
I lived... that was after. I lived above the amusement arcades, which is now the Brasserie now.
Oh, right? yeah.
So I lived above that. Then I moved out of there. I split up with Tom, and I moved out of there, and I moved across the road above Bar Italia on that corner, which was above... And my door would on the roof would go above Cafe Balance, and I would throw things over and... onto them, and I'd go down the stairs and drag boys in through the back door. Anyway, blah blah blah. So I lived on all those four corners for 11 years.
Wow.
And I watched it change so drastically.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't live in Soho now for the love of
no, me. No, me neither.
It's so vile at night.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
Rough as fuck.
Yeah. It's, you know, everyone's getting mugged.
Yeah.
You know, I was talking to someone the other day about the box, that everyone who leaves the box gets mugged.
Gets mugged.
For their watches, the staff have to be walked to their cars.
Really?
Yeah, by security. And the security are getting attacked as well. They're literally, and the police are doing nothing about it.
Yeah. Why? It's just because it's gang-led and stuff, isn't it? So, yeah.
And it's just really, you know, it's the police just don't have the resources.
Yeah.
That's their excuse.
Yeah.
You know,
we'll fast forward a few years and we'll go to Trade.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's talk about Trade.
Trade was a magical place.
Yeah.
I recently did an interview with, I think it was with Faith, with Terry Farley, and I said in it, you know, people go on about Berkheim and they go on about how it's the most wonderful place on earth. They never went to Turnmills.
Yeah. People that don't know that listening, it was Saturday night into Sunday morning, wasn't it?
So no, it's actually Friday night.
Oh, was it?
So Friday night was Gallery.
Right.
Which was at Turnmills. And then that went on until midday. Then Saturday night, Trade opened at 3 a.m.
Right, yeah.
Right, originally. Then it opened, then it started opening at 11. So it went right on till Saturday afternoon.
Right.
Closed at midday.
Right in the middle of Farringdon. Right. Which I guess was derelict, didn't it?
Yeah, literally. On the corner by Farringdon Tube Station. And Turnmills was just one of those places that grew with you.
Mm.
So it started off like an old wine bar that you went downstairs, and then from there it grew into this fucking mega club.
Yeah.
And then it had, then premises next door would shut down, and then buy that and knock into that. And it just grew and grew and grew as the scene grew. And as everything evolved, so did Turnmills.
Yeah.
You know, as the drugs changed, so did Turnmills.
Yeah.
You know,
ecstasy.
You know, you had queues. Like, people were queuing, like, 50 people in a queue for a dealer.
Right.
And the archers, you had, like, an archway, which was Muscle Alley.
Yeah.
Where all the boys would hang out.
Yeah.
And then beyond that was underneath the arches. That's where all the drug dealers were. So you had John, who had this corner here. You had another one who had this corner here. And there was, like, four or five main dealers.
Like a little mini high street.
Yeah, it was like a shopping centre.
Were they all selling different drugs?
Yeah.
That's mad.
It was mental. But you know, it was so hedonistic. You could go there and you'd buy alcohol. Nowhere in London sold alcohol at that time of night.
Right, right, right.
And you'd get it in coffee cups.
Right.
And stuff like that. It was just fucking genius.
Yeah.
Everything about it, the music, it was really hard on the main floor. And then they opened Trade Light with these other DJs called the Sharp Boys.
Yeah, yeah.
They started it with Lawrence. And of course, I came and did a guest set.
Yeah.
And within 3 weeks,
it was mine.
Yeah. I took them over and kicked them out. But, people like, they listen, it's quality over quantity.
Totally.
You know,
yeah,
there was two of them, there was one of me, I was better.
Yeah.
End of story.
Get your money's worth.
Do you get what I'm saying?
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
And it was just, it really was where my life changed drastically when it came to music. I mean, I literally had the freedom of that dance floor. Mm. And I would play for 12 hours.
Wow.
I would play for 10 hours.
Yeah.
I would go on and I'd be so out of it. It would just go on and on. And I would turn the music off and there's that other famous line that I would say, no K, no play.
Yeah.
And people would bring me ketamine.
Yeah.
And then I put the music back on.
Yeah.
You literally I'd turn the whole music off in the whole club.
Until someone fed you drugs.
Until I'm getting drugs, I'm not turning it back on. And people would bring me drugs.
Yeah.
And that's how, and that's the way it was.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And people come and hang out in my DJ box. And I mean, it was so hot in there. It was ridiculous.
Yeah.
But, Turnmills, like everything has its day.
Yeah.
And
culture moved on.
Yeah, of course it does.
Well, I guess the super clubs then sort of erupted around that time. I guess Ministry was opening, Fabric was
opening. Yeah, Ministry opened. It was there was no alcohol at Ministry.
Really?
For about a year and a half.
Like a juice bar.
Yeah. Yeah, because, Paradise Garage didn't have alcohol either.
Oh,
a lot of people don't understand, don't get the concept of that. They would just be like, oh.
Is it just they couldn't get a license?
They just didn't have a license. It was a garage in New York.
Yeah.
But Ministry of Sound opened and it had no drink license. So, and what Justin wanted, Bertman, who when he opened it, wanted it to be like Garage, because when you went to Garage, you went into this other room at Garage which had these big bowls of fruit, and people would help themselves to fruit and hang out and stuff, And he wanted to do the same with Ministry. He wanted to copy that concept. And it took him about a year and a half for him to actually get an alcohol license.
Right. Did that work? That kind of, what was he trying to create?
No.
Yeah.
I mean, it worked at first because it was like, oh, wow, there's this new after hours.
Yeah.
But, of course, when there's no alcohol, people do want to take more drugs.
Yeah.
They have to do something. Because, people disconnect for the reason why they go out.
Yeah.
For me being sober and you being sober and you doing what you do in your life.
Yeah.
When I go to a club now, I go for one reason, either to have a laugh or the main reason is music.
Yeah.
And that's what, when we first go out, right, we don't go to a field in Beckingham, like to a festival or wherever we're going, because there's a barman that makes good cocktails. Or there's a guy called Jack that sells pills that's going to be there.
Yeah.
The first time we go out to listen to DJs to play music. We go out and we suddenly discover
ourselves.
And to find that freedom.
Totally.
And suddenly we get that feeling. That first feeling you get is like the first. Any drug you ever take, music is the strongest and the most powerful drug you'll ever take. Yeah. And when you get that first hit of music in that environment, and like I said at the beginning of this, you've arrived.
Yeah.
You want more.
Yeah.
And you can't get more in that sense. So, of course, what we do is the longer we're out, we think, oh, well, I need something to make me stay out.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's when drugs come into play. And then suddenly it's really sad over the course of time. We forget about the music and we just think about the drugs and we think about the alcohol and we're not there for the main reasons of why we really went.
Yeah.
So when we're headlining a festival or we're headlining, we've got a lot to compete with.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? We could be the best DJs on the planet.
Yeah.
We still got to compete with whatever so-and-so's selling over there,
yeah.
what that one's got in his pocket,
yeah.
what you think he's got in his bag back at home.
Yeah.
We're competing with all of that.
Totally.
And then bringing a mobile phone into the equation as well.
Exactly.
Another different ball game altogether. We're competing with people doing the gram content and all everything else.
Totally.
You know, people forget what the primary concept of nightclubs are about.
And obviously there's this huge disconnect now because of this technology that everyone's got in their hand. And there's just, do you think it's just changed everything?
100%.
Can you see the distinct difference?
100%. You know what? The more and more things that I go to where phones aren't allowed.
Yeah.
It's a whole different world. I just did 3 days at someone's wedding in Miami.
Can't have your phone out.
The phones were taken off of everyone.
Yeah. I went to.
But saying that,
yeah.
Right, there's a really good side to it, right? Like a magical side to it.
Yeah.
Because you're all in the fucking moment.
Yeah.
No one's thinking about, this and all that, or let me check what my dog sitter's doing.
Yeah.
You know, let me go on my cat cam. Do you know what I mean? Or let me go on Grindr.
Refresh. Instagram,
yeah. You know, literally from Facebook to Instagram, Instagram to Facebook.
Twitter.
Because it's all going to change every 3 seconds.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
all of that going on. That's taken away from you, and the power of just being in the moment is so fucking special.
Yeah.
But saying that, right, I had my bag, my phone in my bag illegally, and I went, I just need to go and use the toilet. So I went off to the toilet, which was the phone area where you're allowed to take your phone out. So I had my bag, like, they took it out of the folder. And I for some other reason, I had Ring notifications. All my cameras had gone off at home in London, and I was in fucking Miami. I was being burgled.
No.
Literally,
no.
I went on the Zoom and I was like, oh my God, there's people trying to break in my house.
No.
And I caught them, rang my friend Claire, she got the police. They all went round there. Yeah, literally, all on Zoom. They'd covered all my cameras up.
No.
Yeah, literally, it was insane.
Just a random burglary?
Yeah, caught them.
Fuck. That's amazing.
Literally just took my phone out, literally at that point.
So it's not all bad.
No,
is
it's
it?
Not all bad.
No.
That's what I'm saying. But you know what? It's kind of like, it was just like, that whole difference between not having to compete with technology and everyone being on drugs or wanting drugs or wanting to go to the next place. Because you've got to remember, while they're on that dance floor looking at their phone, other people are in another venue doing exactly the same. And people, you know, when you're in that situation, you automatically think you're missing out.
FOMO.
Oh, my God, always. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Did you not have FOMO pre-mobile phones? Is that a new thing, do you think?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Because, you know, you didn't know where people were until you got a phone call off them the next day when you got home on your landline.
Right.
And then they'd be like, oh, well, we were here. And you'd be like, ah.
Yeah,
it's
like,
I would have come.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And that kind of kept people in that place. That's why, you know, the legendary clubs were legendary because people were in the moment. They weren't in everybody else's pockets.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? They weren't in everybody else's FaceTime places. They weren't like wanting to think, oh, what are they doing? We need to go there.
Yeah.
So-and-so's got this. Do you know what I mean? It just didn't happen the way. And I think that's why legends were made.
Yeah. But I don't think we can, like, ban phones from a club.
No, I don't think you can.
I don't put a sticker over your camera.
Yeah, I mean, that don't work. Yeah. I've done that before. I did a party. Yeah, yeah. My own parties where everything was stickered.
Yeah.
And, you know, people find a way. You know, it's just boring.
Yeah.
I just think that, like anything, it will get to the stage where people don't want to use their fucking phones on dance floors.
Totally.
Do you get what I mean? Totally. I really do think.
I see it already. Like some people like way younger than me are kind of going out and just not putting anything up.
Yeah.
Not really posting much. And I've seen them like before at a club, they haven't posted anything.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, maybe that is a thing that's emerging now.
I think it will. Everything
cyclical,
like,
isn't it?
As I say, it grows big and then it
totally.
Does. You know, technology is the same. It gets to the point where you think, oh, thank God I'm not on that tonight. I'm not having
a good time. Yeah.
And I really think more people connect to music again.
Yeah.
And connect to the real reason why they're there.
Yeah.
because we're fucking DJing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
no, but like, yeah. You really get that connection.
Totally.
It's fucking brilliant.
Yeah.
The more of that, the better, I say.
Yeah. So, you spent £1 million on drugs, and now you're...
Now I'm skinned.
Yeah.
Now homeless.
How long have you been sober? 15 years.
I've been sober 15 and a half years. In,
amazing.
Yeah. In June.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We don't need to... I mean, it's all in the book. Your
it is all in the book.
Amazing book, I'm which really I've glad just read.
You know, my hair's yeah. just been on end.
I mean,
you
it's know what? Beyond the book.
I'm really glad that you read it, because it's not out for like a while. And
be out just as this comes out.
Yeah, yeah. It comes out 26th of May. And
yeah.
It's been a very long time coming,
yeah.
26th of May.
Yeah.
It's for a year we've been waiting for. It's been out on pre-order and... You know, and I've only had the proof copies for about 12 weeks.
Yeah.
And I've been really careful who I gave them to.
Yeah.
Like, normally I'd be like, I want you all to read it.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know what? I gave it to people that I really wanted their real honest opinions.
Yeah.
Because for me, it's, I've got enough yes people.
Yeah.
If I wanted smoke blown up my ass, I would have sent 30 copies to the right people and got that smoke blown up my ass. I didn't want that.
Yeah.
I wanted people to understand it for what it is. Because, you know, it's not what people think it is.
No. I said to you on the phone, I was like, I read it and I was like, it blew my mind. It wasn't the book I thought it was going to be. It's so honest. Yeah. The amount of honesty in the book.
That kind of scares me a little bit, the honesty. You know, it's because I, you know, being honest can get me into a lot of trouble. It always has done.
Yeah.
But now that I'm really honest, and I'm really honest with myself, which is the main thing. And I'm writing this book was a real labour of love, in the sense that I'm not going to do it again.
Yeah.
Everyone's
like,
oh, you've got another book in you. I'm like, I probably have.
Yeah.
But I'm not doing it again.
Yeah.
This is my one book. And I just think that everyone, you know, someone had written, it was really funny, someone had written a fake review on the book's not even up for review.
Yeah.
And someone wrote a fake review. This is how thick people are, right? Yeah. On Amazon, on Waterstones, and they said, "Clang clang as another name drops."
It's not
as
a headline. It's not. It's not.
And then they put, "Oh, what a narcissistic re blah blah blah." So many name drops. Oh my god, it's just embarrassing. This will make a great plant stand. All this.
But they've not read the book.
And I said to my publisher, "Have you read it?" And she was like, "Ugh, that person's never. That person's really jealous of your life." And I was like,
totally.
"That's exactly what it is."
Yeah.
So Waterstones read it and they were like, "It's not even a review. It's not even a healthy review.
Yeah,
one star, whatever." They've not read the book because they would know it's not a name dropping book.
It's not.
There's mentions of certain people, but I've changed everyone's name in the book.
Yeah,
for that reason, it's not a book about other people.
Yeah,
it's a book about me. It's a book about my damage that I caused to myself.
And that's what I was going to say, because obviously we're here to talk about partying and nightlife and stuff, but there's a lot of darkness in the book, and that's sort of been a thing that ran through your life for a long time.
I think that the reason I talk about the dark times is really important. It's not a book where I want people to feel sorry for me, because I've done that all my life, is feel sorry for me. Mm. I've been the victim. I made myself the victim so that it made it easier for me to exist as I was.
Yeah.
And I think my life was really dark. You know, people see me now and they think, oh, my God, he's such a fun guy because of my Instagram or the way I am. I am the way I am because I've had a fucking lot of trauma.
Yeah.
And I can be that way because I've lived that trauma. And to a certain extent, I've overcome most of those problems. Don't get me wrong, I can still create 50 million new problems a day.
Yeah.
But the ones that the major ones that I carried through life with me are in that book. And I write in that book, it's just been, I don't know, I'm very vulnerable about it. I talk about things that I've never discussed before.
Yeah.
And I just thought, you know what? You've got nothing to hide. Mm. You need to show that stuff, because that stuff will help other people.
Absolutely.
You know, there's stuff in there about HIV and AIDS and, you know, I should be dead.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? There's a chapter in the book that describes what I went through in that era. And, you know, I should be dead.
Yeah.
There's no two ways about it. I shouldn't be here.
In hospital.
I was in hospital for nearly fucking 5 months. I was in a coma. I'd lost all my T cells. I had full blown AIDS. And, you know, people are like, oh, you can't have full blown. And I had 116 T cells left. That was under the notification of being full blown A.
Yeah.
And they put me into a coma, and they told my parents I wasn't going to come through, and they all needed to come and see me, blah, blah, blah. And
you had your rights read to you.
Yeah, they read the last rites on. And then a week later, they put me on this miracle new drug called Tizavir, mm-hmm. and they pumped me full of it. And I pulled through.
Yeah.
When I was diagnosed at that point in time, it was in the multi-millions, the viral load in my brain. I had to have lumbar punches every day. No, I was blacking out. I just thought I was having a good time.
Right. Were you still using drugs at this point?
I was still doing drugs. I was like completely at my worst point in time. My mum came to my house and found me unconscious on the floor in the kitchen and took me to hospital. And I got to the hospital. I said, why am I here? I want to go home.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh, no, it's just, no. It's been happening all the time. It's just it's just what I'm used to. And it was happening all the time because I had this virus in my brain that was shutting down parts of my brain.
Yeah.
And I was dying.
Yeah.
But in my head, I still thought it was drink and drugs that was doing it. And I really thought that that was it. That was where it was going.
Yeah.
But, it was very sad. But I've put it all in the book, and I think it's really it needs to be in the book.
Mm.
But it is not a book about other people.
No,
some
of it's a hard. It's a hard read as a reader.
And I've given it to my best friends, and some of them haven't been able to read all of it because they're struggling with it.
I did it in two halves. It was about a 3-week break in the middle, so it was a bit like, whew. So it's amazing. How was it going back to DJing when you came out of rehab? How was it sober?
Firstly, I didn't go back to DJing. I went forward to DJing.
Mm.
So that was my primary purpose. I wasn't going back to anything.
Yeah.
Going backwards would have just led to failure.
Yeah.
I, like anything in my life, if it's something that pops back up or something I have to do, I will go forward to it in a different way.
Yeah.
So going forward to DJing after rehab was a big thing.
Yeah.
I'd vocalised where I'd been. I wasn't. I hadn't hidden where I'd been.
Yeah.
I publicised it in every magazine. Yeah. It was like, I did like a whole big, like expose, like of the cover of QX magazine, which was the biggest little gay scene magazine. Yeah.
They even make that anymore?
No. But at that point, it was like it was like the mecca.
Everyone would grab QX on a Thursday.
That's right.
To see what was going on at the weekend. That's right. All the club posters.
I did the cover of that. And just basically was really, just did my rehab diary. So I knew there was no going back, thank God. So they took me about four or five months to actually get my head around, okay, I want to go forward with this.
Yeah.
And because for me, I used to think, how can anyone DJ sober?
Mm.
How would they get the same energy off the dance floor as they would? But it's not about the energy off the dance floor. It's about what you give to you give that energy to the dance floor, which they reciprocate and give back to you.
Totally.
So it's about feeling. And that's where the reconnection came. Suddenly I discovered music again. I discovered it wasn't just a way and means to earn money to get drugs. It was a way and means to actually reconnect with what I really loved.
Mm.
And I think that was the turning point.
Yeah.
That was that point where the light had come back on again. That ignition light had just like kicked in. I just thought, I love my job again.
Yeah. Is there a record that reminds you of that moment and that era? Kings of Tomorrow. Sort of
Kings thing. Of Tomorrow. Yeah. There was one record which is by Soldiers of Twilight, which is called Believe. And the lyrics to that song changed my life because it's like it's in my in the book in the on the thank yous page, which you haven't read yet because I just finished it. On the last page, it says at the bottom, the last line is, "If when we believe, we are halfway there," and that comes from that Soldiers of Twilight song because it's so true. The minute that you start to believe, you're kind of halfway to conquering something.
Yeah.
It's like, when we start to believe in ourselves again, we become halfway of over at conquering that anxiety that we have around stuff and around ourselves. The minute that we believe we're not a fat cunt or a fat arsehole or a fat this, it's the minute that we start to feel good about ourselves. And I just think, that one song, those lyrics, I can listen to it all day long and it makes me cry. And I can't listen to it right now at the moment because I've lost my dog and... Yeah. Anything at the moment sends me over the edge. And, Soldiers of Twilight and Kings of Tomorrow, those songs.
Yeah.
They were there in my using and I would listen to them all the time. And now I play them like we do out this, our brunch on a Saturday full fat thing. And I play those tunes and it's magical because it's the euphoria that I get from those songs.
Yeah.
just lifts me now. They're not sad songs.
Music's so amazing how it can just take you to a place, or it's the emotion that it
it's
creates.
It's a time machine.
It's just the sound. It's so amazing, isn't it?
You know what it is? Well, I always say this to people now, that, you know, when people go, oh, will you teach me to DJ? I'm like, no one can teach you to DJ.
No, I agree.
Said, you know, do you listen to music? And they're like, yeah. And I'm like, okay, well, maybe you shouldn't be a DJ.
Yeah, do you
and
feel...
they're like, what do you mean? I'm like, well, if... there's a difference between listening to something and feeling something.
Totally.
Do you feel music? And they're like, yeah, I do. And I'm like, well, you should be a DJ.
Yeah.
Because that's what it's about. I feel everything I play.
Yeah.
I don't ever put something on and just think, let this hurry up and finish and put something else on. I feel it.
Yeah.
Those vibrations, that bass line, that one bit of strings, that one vocal, all of that stuff, I feel. Yeah. It has... look, even talking about it makes my hair stand on it. Yeah. Because... that's why I've stood the test of time, because I feel what I do.
Yeah.
I don't listen to it. Yeah. People go, oh, do you listen to music at home? I'm, no, I don't. I feel music at home.
I don't listen
to music.
Yeah.
It's a different thing. You know, I recently discovered Gong Bath.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And it was about vibrations. And, you know, I kind of was thinking, oh, God, here we go. What load of old hippie crap is that?
Yeah.
Wow.
Really?
Wow.
Wow.
Made me cry within like 2 weeks. Just the sound and the vibration, just to connect to it.
Did you lie on the floor and they sort of do...
yeah, you can do it. I stood in front of it and this girl came in. It was in the woods.
Right.
And I was doing a little mini documentary for the Wilderness Project. And we're in the woods and she started doing this gong bath. And literally I burst into tears. Wow. And I was just like... because it just, the vibrations and the sound just overwhelmed me and just wrapped me. And I was just like, wow. And it was so transcendent.
Yeah.
I almost like felt like I was having an out of body experience.
It, wow.
You know, and that's through feelings.
I want to do one now. Got to do
it.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
And, you know, it just put me in touch with so many different things. And, you know, I have that same feeling when I play Kings of Tomorrow or I play certain tracks, you know, at the moment it's like, I wish I didn't miss you anymore. Oh my God, it's just been to fly my eyes. But all of that stuff, you know, I had that because that's that connection.
Yeah, yeah.
It's incredible.
And let's talk about your life as a DJ. Do you ever get nervous before you play?
Every time.
Do you?
All the time. Yeah. All the time. I think the day that I don't get nervous is the day I should stop.
The day you don't, it's the day you stop caring, right?
Yeah. Because you know what? Even if, you know, I suffer really badly with imposter syndrome.
Mm.
I could be sitting, like I was the other week, on a plane going to do probably the biggest event of the year, like social event of the year, and I'd be on this flight and I would just think, everyone's going to hate me when I get there. They're all going to slag me off. Yeah. They're all going to hate what I'm playing. But they're flying me in to do it.
Totally.
Do you get what I mean?
I think that's a creator. I think probably most creatives
get this. I think it's really healthy. And I will sit in the cab and I will pray. And I don't give a fuck who knows that I pray.
Yeah.
I work a 12-step program. I have a higher power.
Yeah.
For me, that connection, I have to hand this stuff. I have to vocalise this stuff.
Yeah.
Because if I don't vocalise it, it stays in here and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger and becomes something it isn't.
Yeah.
So the more I vocalise this stuff, wherever I've been praying, I have to do that because... I have such anxiety around gigs.
Yeah.
You know, I will DJ and there'll be like however many people. Every gig to me is like Madison Square Gardens.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the same feeling of thinking, oh my God, there's so many people there, I have to perform, you know.
Yeah.
And it's a really healthy thing.
Totally.
Because it keeps me on my toes.
Yeah.
You know, the day that you know, I always say nothing good comes from being comfortable.
Yeah.
The more uncomfortable you are with things, the more you're going to do it better.
Totally.
Do you get what I'm saying, Chuck?
Yeah, yeah.
And if I go there and I'm like, oh, this is a piece of piss.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
You don't care as much anymore.
No, of course you don't.
I think I know the answer to this as well, but what's the best DJ set you've ever done?
I haven't done it yet.
Yeah, and I
really believe that. It's like, you know, people go, oh, what's the best job you've ever done? There's been millions of them.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know what? I always think, I haven't done it yet.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there's always something fucking more amazing coming along.
Yeah,
honestly.
Totally.
Things come along and I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm
gonna do it.
I've got this gig thing that I'm doing in a couple of weeks' time. Yeah. Which is on top of a tower block.
Yeah.
They've just built this tallest building in, and I'm DJing at the opening of it on the roof
with
drones and blah, 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 blah. And I was like, oh, it sounds really naff.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, like, it's going to be incredible at night as the sun's going, you know, it's like, and they're like, you know, we're going to do this film around it. And I'm like, all right, okay.
Yeah.
Do you get what I mean? But it's like, it, you know, but that comes from fear.
Totally. Me, slagging like, it off
yeah,
when it comes
it's
in.
Just rubbish. Yeah. Do you get what I mean? And it's amazing. Do you know, these things are real feel good, like pinch me moments.
Totally.
Do you get what I mean? Like really pinch me moments. Totally. And I just think, you know, and I just think I'm so blessed to be in that position.
Totally.
You know, I was just about to start my own residency in Ibiza.
Yeah.
At 56.
Yeah,
what
yeah,
the fuck?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I've got a residency. I'm doing, they wanted me to do 19 weeks. And I was like, nah. If I was 21, I would say yeah to 19 weeks. Come on. But no, I can't.
How many are you doing?
I am doing seven.
So you're going to stay out and you're going to have a little extended
I'm going
stay.
Over for the first one for a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
And then I'm back and it's book time.
Yeah.
And then it's in and out for the most of the summer.
Yeah.
One night there, one night back. And then there's some weeks where I'm there twice in a week, but I'm back in London in the middle of it all and everywhere else. Now I'm in Venice. But like, so
but
there's a lot of that.
An important place for you as well.
It's a massive place for me. And, you know, I'm really blessed to even be considered to have a residency with Idris Elba and David Guetta.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? On a Friday night at high.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's kind of, it's amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing just to have been given that chance together. And I truly believe that if I wasn't a junkie for 28 years and I didn't almost kill myself every day and want to kill myself every day, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now.
Yeah.
You know, I had that small little holiday for 28 years.
Yeah.
But like, I'm still
functioning.
Little break. Little break. But you know what? Recovery has given me so much in my life. And I will talk about recovery because it's given me everything, Jay.
Yeah.
It's given me absolutely everything. It's like, it's given me freedom to be who I am.
Yeah.
And to actually love who I am and not hate myself for being who I am. And just, my career's just gone through the roof in the sense that because I believe in myself again and I believe in music and I believe in other people, which is
totally
a big thing.
And also on people as well. You've got so many amazing friends around you. Loads of people have stuck by you for forever. You've got loads of new friends. And you always, because you do a birthday party every year, you always do a big birthday dinner. And it's always so beautiful because you've just got so many people around you that love you, you know, me included. And do you love doing a birthday party? You love a birthday party,
You know what? I love doing a birthday party a month before the birthday. But on the day, I always think, why the fuck have I done this?
Yeah.
Why did I put myself through it?
Yeah.
And I get all the anxiety.
Oh, okay.
You know what? I do love a birthday party. I do love a party.
Yeah.
And I just think, you know, for someone that wanted to die every day, I think a celebration of life is a really big thing and it's a really good thing to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not about... you know, I used to do countdowns to my birthday when I was a kid, and I with birthday lists of what I wanted and everything like that. And it's always been a big thing.
Literally, nothing's changed. No. We talk about when you were a kid. This is now.
Do you know what I mean? It's, you know, I love a good party, and I love to be have my friends around me, and I am blessed.
Yeah.
I've got so many amazing friends, and you know, some of them do have amazing careers themselves, and they're not my friends because they have an amazing career.
Totally.
They were my friends before they had any career.
Totally.
And, you know, I come from a very creative time where people got off their asses and didn't have a phone in their hands and actually had to find their own platforms to stand up and shout out, look at me, this is me.
Yeah.
And their careers springboarded from that. And I just think that, you know, I'm very blessed to have that in my life.
Yeah. Totally. Mm. I'm going to give you some quick fire questions.
Go ahead.
Maddest thing you've ever seen when you've been DJing? You've seen it all. So
The maddest thing I've ever seen while I was DJing. I don't know. I can't answer it. I was going to say the maddest thing I've ever seen when I was DJing. A mass orgy in the middle of the dance floor. Not in a sex club, but in a straight club. Yeah.
Fabulous.
Yeah.
Maddest thing you've done when you've been DJing? Not now.
Actually, DJing.
Yeah.
Actually, mixing.
Yeah.
Didn't mix for about 20 years. Jesus Christ. The things that I've done while I was DJing. I mean, just, I'll tell you one quick one. The maddest one was they flew me to Palladium. I went on Concorde. Steve Rebell picked me up from the airport. I went to Palladium, DJed. I literally got to Palladium. All my friends were there, and they'd all given me grand bottles of MDMA. And I was like, it's not working. And I put one record on in the Mike Todd room at Palladium. I bent down to get another record and I came up like Cookie Monster. And I was like, we've got to go. And everyone's like, what? The whole party's come to see you from New York, from London. And I was like, we've got to go. We've got to leave. And I put a record and then we left.
So you flew to New York.
They flew me over by Concorde. Flew me over. I left. The next day, right, listen to this. The next day, they ring me. Steve Lewis, who was Steve Rebell's right-hand man, rang me and was like, hey, great set last night. Everyone was talking about it. Except, fuck, man. God, they loved you. They loved you. I was like, oh, thanks.
Same again next week.
Literally, yeah. They flew me over again 2 weeks later. Literally, I was like, I played one record.
Oh, my God.
That was the maddest thing I've ever done.
What is on your DJ rider?
On my DJ rider now, I've just changed it, actually.
Yeah, what's on it?
Before it was 6 bottles of coconut water, like cartons of coconut six bottles of coconut water, black fluffy towels, and...
Black fluffy towels?
Yeah, my agent being a wanker.
Right, what is it?
Because I turn up and play something like, why is there black towels and why do I keep getting coconut water? I hate coconut water. It's changed. Now I put Jack Daniels and whiskey... and vodka on there because people are like, I thought you didn't drink. I'm like, it's not for them, it's for my friends.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Because all my mates would come with me and they'd be in the green room and they'd be like, cans of Diet Coke.
Yeah.
And they'd be like, and I'd be like, yeah, I know. So now I put that on the road.
Okay, nice.
You know, it's not, you know.
It's all about, yeah.
No, I want people that come with me to have a party, man.
Finally, you're throwing a party.
Yeah.
Who's name like three people who are on the guest list who you've got to have there and who's the DJ and can't be you?
Oh, well, it wouldn't be me anyway. Okay, so who would have to be there?
Yeah, three to five guests, dead or alive.
Ooh, that's a big one.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, obviously, I would say you because whenever I have a birthday party or any party, we always get you to come along because you're value for money.
Yeah.
You know, you can make balloon animals in the corner, come in riding your little clown bike.
Totally. Get your bang for your buck.
You know, honestly, it's real value for money. If you're having a party, get Jodie. She's amazing. So then, I don't know who else. I don't know. I'd like to say. I don't know. I couldn't really say the sick. I suppose it would be Stabby, my boyfriend, obviously, you know, you have to. I'd say George, Boy George as well, because he's amazing. Kate, she's fucking brilliant, always at a party. You can't have a party without her.
No, agreed.
Karen Binns.
Yep, love.
Is genius as well.
Fashion stylist.
Yes, a totally fashion stylist, but also pure party animal.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I would say Daniel Lismore because he's just always at every party anyway. Even if I didn't invite him, he'd be there.
Where in the kitchen sink?
I mean? Literally, he would be there. Yeah. You turn around and be like, hang on.
Hello. Wearing like 12 outfits.
Do you know what? There's so many people. And I just, you know, there's so many people that aren't with us anymore that I would love there as well from back in the day. You know. I don't know. It's a tough one. Thanks for throwing that one on me.
Yeah, yeah.
And what was the rest of the question?
Who's DJing?
Who's DJing?
Yeah.
Well, as I said, it would be you, and that's not honestly because I'm with you, but you always do our stuff.
Yeah.
I love you.
Love you. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you.
Oh, that was so fun.
Oh, your wig just cut my eye.
Thank you. That's good, that was fun.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.